from the crypt.
Hello, boys and ghouls. Welcome to a very special interview episode of Dads from the Crypt. My name is Jason, and today I'm joined by Greg Nicotero and John Harrison, the masterminds behind Shudder's Creep Show. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yes. John, it's always a pleasure to have you on. How Greg, are you?
He's the real mastermind behind Creep Show. I'm just a hired hand.
Well, they hire you a lot, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But, Greg, this is your first time on Dads in the Crypt, so I want to hear your origin story, where you're from, What were your movie influences growing up, and how you got into makeup and effects.
Well, I grew up in Pittsburgh, and in the North Hills. And, you know, because of the pedigree of Bill Cardill and Chiller Theater, and my parents' love for horror movies. That was it. You know, I mean, I watched Chiller Theater. I read Famous Monsters magazine. Lo and behold, I discovered when I was about 13 that there was this guy named George Romero who made movies in Pittsburgh. You know, Night of the Living Dead obviously was made in the late 60s. And this was before Dawn of the Dead had come out. So it was one of those unique scenarios where Tom Savini has the same story. You know, he found out that he didn't have to go to Hollywood to make movies, that he could make movies in his hometown. And I became, I ironically met George on a family vacation to Rome when he was there meeting with Dario about Dawn of the Dead. And we were at a restaurant, and I was like, holy shit, that's George Romero. And went over and said hello to him, and he was kind of blown away that this 15-year-old kid from Pittsburgh is, like, coming up to him at a restaurant in Rome. And, you know, George was always, once you're in the family, you know, he's like, you should come down to the office on Fort Pitt Boulevard and come visit. And so he kind of invited me into the fold, like, almost instantly. And, you know, my fascination continued to grow. I think once I knew George, I met Tom when they were shooting Creepshow and was invited to visit the set quite often. And that's where John was there. And so by the time Day of the Dead comes around in 1984, you know, the irony was they had offered me a job on Creepshow to be a production assistant. And I was just about ready to go away to college to study pre-med. So I said, yeah, it would be great. But, I don't think I could do it. I'm supposed to be a doctor. I got to go to school. and then, you know, we stayed in touch. I got to be really good friends with Tom. So that kind of seemed to be a no-brainer. And then in 84, Day of the Dead pops up and it's the same conversation. Hey, we got Day of the Dead. Do you want a job as a PA? And this time I didn't say no. I said, I want to be Tom's assistant. And, you know, at that point, you know, they loved the idea of having somebody manage Tom because it was a big show. Day of the Dead had a lot of work, more than Tom had ever done before. And they loved the idea that I would be the guy interacting with production. I would be the guy hiring the crew, ordering the supplies, and sort of keep Tom free to do what Tom does so well, which is come up with these creative gags. So I kind of, you know, ran the department for him. That's when John and I met and fell in love officially. And, you know, it was, I never went back. You know, the intention always was, yeah, I'm going to take a semester off of school. I'm going to do this movie and then I'm going to go back and be a doctor. And that just, you know, 800 movies and 40 years later, I still have never gone back to school. So that's the history. And I owe everything to George. I owe everything to Tom. You know, I owe a lot to John and the crew of Day of the Dead because they welcomed me into the family. And that's one of the big reasons why John and I continue to collaborate after four decades is because we are family. I know I can rely on him. You know, as soon as Creepshow came up for me, there was no doubt that I wanted John to be a part of it in whatever capacity he wanted to be. I wanted him to write. I wanted him to direct. You know, Savini was there. Rick Catazone was there. I feel like I've spent a lot of my career repaying George's goodwill by continuing his legacy. And this is a great opportunity. So there you go. That was quick too. That was only like 5 minutes. That could have gone for
now. How did you become involved with Shudder's Creepshow?
Well, another really crazy story, because when I was younger, I had a video camera. I had one of those old Beta cameras that you stick the tape in and you can carry around. And I had a poster for Creepshow on the wall in my office, in my basement in Pittsburgh. And my brother found a video that I was filming that said to my parents, saying, "Mom, Dad, one day you're going to see my name on that poster." And it was a Creepshow poster. So I was doing publicity in Australia, and I was like, I need a book to read so that I can, you know, on the plane. I got like a 19-hour flight. So I'm sitting with my iPad. The plane's getting ready to take off. And this book pops up called Knights of the Living Dead. And I'm like, what the hell is this, Knights of the Living Dead? So I look at it, and it's like stories by different authors that all take place the same night as Night of Living Dead took place. And I went, oh, my God, that's fucking awesome. So I downloaded the book, and there was one story written by a guy named Craig Engler called Dead Girl Named Sue that I fell in love with. And I thought, you know what? I'm between seasons on Walking Dead. I'd love to go shoot this as a short film. Like, I wanted to make it. So we tracked him down, and turns out he was the president of Shudder, and was like, wait a minute, well, you know, why are you asking me about this story? I said, because I love it, and I think it's really cool, and it's Romero, and, you know, I love the vibe and the feel for it. And literally, like, I get a phone call from his partner named Stan Spry saying, oh, well, you know, we're talking about resurrecting Creepshow. You have a deal at AMC. We need a creative. We need somebody who can run the show. What do you think? And I'm like, Creepshow, like my Creepshow, like, you know. So interestingly enough, we had pitched it to AMC because we wanted it to be on AMC, and AMC didn't want to pay for it, so it ended up on Shudder at a lesser budget, of course. Which they still, to this day, continue to be, oh, we should have just taken Creepshow when we had the chance. So, you know, so we dove in, and that was kind of it. Then it was all about me kind of reaching out to everybody and anybody that I could to get season one going. You know, I reached out to Steve King. I reached out to Joe Hill. You know, Steve was like, I have the perfect story for you. I have the perfect story. He gives me Survivor Type as the first story for Creepshow, which, of course, we could have never afforded to do because it's on an island in the middle of the ocean. But Steve was on board. Joe Hill was on board. We got a bunch of really great actors. We got Adrian back. We got Tobin. We got... you know, we got Giancarlo Esposito. You know, I was calling everybody, all my friends, like literally texting everybody that I knew, because I'm like, who knows if I'm going to get another season or another chance.
I came down to do two, Greg, in the first season. And then you asked me to, or two stories in one episode. And then you said, I've got these other two. Can you stay? And we did those. But interestingly enough, as we went in through the next couple of seasons, I got a chance to do the very story that Greg was just talking about. I knew Craig Engler from the sci-fi days when he was at sci-fi and I was doing the Dune miniseries. And I had actually seen him in New York, and he had told me, we're trying to get Greg to do a new Creepshow series. Would you be interested? I said, you know, just sign me up. I'm there whenever he says. And in the, I forget which season it was, Greg, you said, well, I want to do Dead Girl Named Sue. And we did it. It was one of the best episodes that I did. I mean, I am so proud of that episode because we did it in black and white. We did it as if it were the same time frame that George did Night of the Living Dead. Mm. And it turned out great. We had a great cast. Rob Draper, who was the cinematographer, did a beautiful job on the look of it. So ironically, it just all came full circle because then I was working with Craig Engler again on a story that Greg had found that started the whole thing up.
Craig didn't want us to do that story in season one. I think he felt a little awkward about the fact that we were putting, as the head of the studio, one of his stories in. I think he felt a little uncomfortable about that. So we didn't do it on season one. But it was really, I had no idea what I was getting myself into when we did Creepshow. I had been working for 10 years on Walking Dead, and you know, you have standing sets and you have, you know, you've reoccurring cast, and the idea that we went in with the concept of shooting two stories per episode at 3.5 days each story. And every 3.5 days, you'd have a new cast, a new script, new locations. It was so freaking ambitious. And I think we really were just like, it existed out of sheer force of will more than anything else. Because we got there and our line producer was like, they should shut this. Like the first week, the line producer said, you're never going to have enough money to make the show. They should just shut it down now. Don't even bother. And so I'm like, well, gee, this is going to be fun. The line producer doesn't even want to make the show. And, you know, we found our way through it. It was really long. I was rewriting a lot of the scripts while we were in prep to make sure that the scripts fit into the window. You know, I hired a lot of my Walking Dead crew because they were loyal and they were willing to do anything that we needed to do to get the show done. And it was great. It was like riding a bucking Bronco. I wanted to preserve the anthology feel. You know, mm-hmm. I think originally I went into it kind of thinking about Night Gallery. Because I remember there was Night Gallery episodes where they would have one story that was one shot. Like, I'll never forget, it was like, there was one Night Gallery episode. There was one shot, and it's like, a baby's crying, and the baby's crying, and then the parents come in, and they bring the baby bottle in, and they're like, oh, he's so cute, and the baby won't stop crying, they give him the baby. And then they cut to the crib, and it's Frankenstein in the crib. And the Frankenstein says, thanks, Daddy, and drinks the bottle, and then breaks the crib. That was it. It was like two shots. And I thought, you know, a lot of those comic books and things, the original thought was, let's do three little vignettes per episode. And one of them could be a 30-second or a minute-long little thing. I just thought it would be kind of fun. And, you know, I wanted really it to be like, you're reading a comic book and you get the first story and the pages blow open. I wanted it to be like the original movie. So that was the plan and the intent. And, you know, we had a lot of great, you know, we had great stories. Joe Lansdale gave us a story. Joe Hill, you know, we had David Bruckner directed and Roxanne Benjamin directed. We had a lot of really great people in season one that all came in. And ironically enough, I remember David Bruckner saying to me after the fact, he was like, dude, I learned so much on that shooting Creepshow with you. You know, when we were doing it, he, you know, it was a little bit like, you know, a lot of the directors that come off of independent filmmaking, they don't really, sometimes they don't understand what it's like to sort of collaborate with, you know, you're dealing with a budget, you're dealing with time frame. If it's independent, you can kind of do whatever you want. Oh, yeah, you know, let's go do this today. And it was a really challenging for a couple of the directors. And I remember after the fact, they were like, it was like the greatest. It was a really great experience because it really made me understand different elements of filmmaking that they hadn't been exposed to yet. The beauty for John was John's a fucking pro. You know, John's directed a ton of stuff. And I could count on him. You know, I never went to set. I never looked at John like, I don't know. And I gave him episodes that he didn't even want. And he's like, dude, how the fuck am I going to make a scary episode out of a dollhouse? What the fuck are you giving me this? He didn't want it. And it turned out to be probably the best received episode. You know, of course, I gave him Kaylee Fleming, who's a rock star and a half. But John looked at me like, Greg, I don't know. Like, why do you want me to direct this? And I was like, well, somebody has to. I said, John, it'll be great. You'll find it. I promise you. And when you, the minute you turn the camera on Kaylee, all your work is done because she is that good of an actress. And so, ironically, we led with that episode. That was our first, I think that one and Grey Matter were the first, the first two episodes that we aired. And it was a Stephen King one. And then it was that one. And people fucking loved it. People went crazy for it. And I was really grateful. I'm still grateful for the response the show gets. Nobody knows it's out there because Shudder does really not much to promote it. But people, I would say 99% of the people that talk to about the show are like, when are you doing more? We love it. It's so much fun. You've captured the spirit of what it's like to do those, you know, sort of 70s. Kind of vibe, you know, you got a different monster in each show. There's glee, there's joy. It's really something that it's unlike anything else that's on TV. And I'm very proud of the fact that I feel like we sort of led that horror anthology.
We're still recording, so we can just keep rolling. All right. Let me back up just because I have some questions I want to make sure I hit. So John, what in between
then you the dark side and you have good scripts
so then you can be considered a lot of the job is already done. Anthology what did you Amy Holmberg use to
and make a the show. Cinematographer that both Greg and I have worked with a number of times in the past, so the communication was already at a very, very high level.
Yeah, I've talked about it before, but The House of the Head is just one of the most tense episodes of TV I've ever seen, and it's so simplistic but so nerve-wracking, especially with a daughter approximately the same age. It just tickles that fear, that parental fear reflex in me. And I remember this came out
when... Well, the funny thing about that was, you know, when we were developing all the scripts, you know, it was really one of the first times for me that I would read the short story and then wrestle with the writers, like find the best story and make sure that it's affordable. And you know, I remember calling Josh one day, it was before we started production, and saying, hey, what if at the end of the script, she grabs the head and pulls it out of the house and throws it into her bedroom. And then when she finds it, it's a full size head. Oh, he was so mad because he hadn't thought of it. He's like, why is that not in the story? That should have been in the short story. That's such a great idea. So it was a really unique opportunity because of my pedigree. You know, I mean, look, I've spent my career sort of developing this kind of stuff, finding the scares. How do you make something scary? What element is missing that the audience will have a visceral reaction to? The blood and the gore is the easy part. And, you know, the years of experience I have creating moments, you know, like we've been sort of redoing our K&B portfolio lately. And I went through fucking 35 years of stuff. And one page has Casino, Misery, and Reservoir Dogs. And I put all those on one page because I thought those were the page, those were the gags that we built that emptied the theaters. The people walked out. Reservoir Dogs, they walked out. The Head and the Vice on Casino, they walked out. And the Ankle Break in Misery. So having part of that is my history of somebody who was instrumental in designing those with people like Quentin and with people like Martin Scorsese and Rob Reiner, and understanding that this was now a chance for me to do it for myself on my show. So to find the scares, and you know, there was the last day of shooting, I'll never forget this. John was, I forget what you were doing, John. I think we were like, it was like one of those frantic, it's the last day of shooting. Here's a list of all the shots we need from every episode. And it's like a close-up of a hand opening a door or this or that. And I was in the corner. I was in the corner. This was season one. I was over in the corner with the house shooting little pickup pieces of the figures reacting to the cop and then moving them a little bit, and then the cops decapitated and they're reacting, and it was all those little pieces. So it just was, I think also because of my experience, you know, the one thing that, and then I'll stop and let John talk. You know, the one thing that I have that not a lot of other filmmakers have is I've been on set for 40 years. Like, I grew up and came into the industry. I wasn't a writer. I wasn't somebody who worked in an office and then found my way onto set. I began my career on set, and I stood next to people like George and Toby Hooper and John Carpenter and Wes Craven and like the greatest filmmakers of our generation. I've had the opportunity to collaborate with. So for me, that's been the greatest film school opportunity that you can have. And that I do think that that's what sets me aside from a lot of other people, is my understanding of how a set works, my understanding of effects and drama, and the fact that I would be in the makeup trailer with the actors at the beginning, and I knew how to get the actors to trust me. If you have an actor that trusts you, then you're golden. And I was able to do that. So that's, you know, and then I just surround myself with people like John and Rob Draper and Amy and my team. And you know, Creepshow became something really special.
Okay. I'll just keep talking to, we're still recording, so I'll keep talking to Greg.
Well, usually when we shoot them, we pair them from a production standpoint. You know, we pair them whichever one is the easiest to shoot. Once we have them shot and we edit them together, then we decide after they're edited which ones we want to lead with. You know, obviously, you know, we want to lead with our stronger episodes, and then we like to end with our stronger episodes as well. So a lot of times, you know, like for season four, we opened with Smile, which was one that John directed. And then the other one was 20 Minutes with Cassandra, which was one that I directed with Samantha Sloyan and Ruth Codd.
Really good. And
I thought that those two stories, again, you know, Creepshow is so different. And I think what surprises people about it is there's a lot of my sensibilities in the show. Like, they don't all have to be gory. They don't have to all be outrageous. But I want them to be entertaining. And I want to take the audience on a different journey. Every story has to be different. You know, that's one of the successes of the show. So
absolutely,
when you watch something like Cassandra in 20 minutes, you have no idea where that story's going. And the performances were so good. And that literally came out of me watching Midnight Mass and calling Jamie Flanagan and saying, I need you to write an episode of Creepshow for me. And he was like, I don't have anything for you. I'm sorry. I mean, I really appreciate you thinking of me. And then a half an hour later, he said, actually, maybe I think I might have something for you. And I just, I fell in love with the story. And that, you know, and so you get a different experience every time you watch an episode.
That's the beauty of an anthology series. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, Greg has curated stories that aren't all one thing. They aren't all monster stories. Mm-hmm. They all aren't gore stories. There's plenty of that. And the ones that I've had an opportunity to do have been really a lot of fun to do, because that goes way back to the original stuff with George. But I've also had a chance to do the ones that are really psychological horror, which is what Smile is. And to some extent, what 20 Minutes with Cassandra is, because it's really about her and her relationship to this thing. I mean, in the middle of this story, there's like, what, Greg? Like about a 5-minute dialogue scene where the two of them are just sitting there talking.
You know, John Esposito, who, again, is part of the family. I've known John, God, since after Day of the Dead. And he had that script for a long, long time. And when Creepshow got going, I literally called him and said, I want to do your Monkey's Paw script. He said, I really want us to, I want to make that episode. It's pure Creepshow. It's really got that morality. It's got the revenge. It's got the bad guy comeuppance aspect of it. Everything about it, I felt, you know, and, you know, too, I think because that was one of the first ones that we shot, that gave me, when John was prepping it, I remember going to John and saying, look, we can't shoot the car crash. We can't shoot this. We can't shoot that. So I'm going to have comic book pages drawn that will illustrate a lot of that. Even when Bruce gets to the cemetery, we can cut to comic book pages in between to fill out elements that we can't shoot because we don't have the time or the money. So
yeah, it was great.
It saved us, you know, like it saved us, and we were being clever about it and smart about it. So, you know, doing that when somebody would come in and say, look, it's going to take us half a night to shoot a car crash when the car goes off the cliff. And I'm like, well, we don't have a half a night to do that. So I hired Ron Frenz and Rick Catazone in Pittsburgh, who worked on the original Creepshow, and Ron used to draw for all those comic book, those old school comics, and I had them draw it. And then we did fun sound design, and we did the sound design, and then it made it feel like a comic book come to life.
Yeah, well, that's the
genius. And what was great about it is that it was totally consistent with the original Creepshow. I mean, you completely honored it, Greg, by making it and the screen panels and the other thing, enough money to do the graveyard. We had to create that almost as a surreal set.
Yeah, as a viewer, I love it because, yeah, it ties it really into the show. And also the use of, like, the splash colors.
Mm-hmm.
The working with the budget. Mm-hmm.
Well, look, that's the way filmmaking is. You know, it's like it's like the famous story when they were shooting Jaws and the shark didn't work, and someone's like, "Yeah, just tow that yellow barrel from there to there, and we'll let the audience know that the shark is near and it's underneath." You know, you have to be clever and you have to be ingenious. And you know, my experiences on the various movies that I've worked on really allowed me to sort of troubleshoot problems. Oh, we can't do that? Shit. All right, well, let's do this. And that was, you know, really, that was most of my job. And, you know, so we finished season one. I feel like when we got to season two and three with that we shot back to back, I really could breathe a little bit, because as much of a bucking bronco as season one was, and I felt like I was holding on for dear life, now we had done it and the show was a success and everything that I had hoped for. So when we got to season two, I feel like I lightened up a little bit and I was a little freer. You know, when we did Shapeshifters Anonymous, which is a completely out there episode, it's so random and it's so wild. But I had so much fun writing and directing that episode because it was outrageous in a way that like Jordy Verrill was outrageous, you know, and that some of the stories just needed to be fun. So I read that story and just went, okay, this should be it. And we ended up releasing it as a Christmas special, which I thought was brilliant. But I think I would definitely say for season two and three, I definitely had a lot more fun. You know, the Public Television of the Dead and Night of the Living Late Show. Oh, yeah. And those episodes were so me. Those episodes, you know, the Sam Raimi one and the George Romero one and the stuff that I had directed. And, you know, and then we got into Queen Bee, which was sort of my John Carpenter hospital, spooky hospital alien movie, which I was able to channel my John Carpenter. So I feel like when we got into seasons two and three, I really could breathe. And the episodes really show to me a lot more confidence in what the show is intended to look. And DJ, who starred in it, mm-hmm. you know, it was really interesting because we brought him in. He got there like 2 days before, and we really had a great time together. And he actually pulled me aside and said, you know, he said, this industry's rough. He said, this industry's really rough. And there was a moment when I was kind of about to throw in the towel. And then he said, then I came down here and I had this opportunity to collaborate with you. And I watched you and your crew. And I saw how much passion you had for it. He said it really rejuvenated my love for the business. And that was like probably one of the nicest compliments that I've ever gotten, because we were having a good time, and it was basically him in the whole episode. You know, there's nobody else, him and the monster. And, you know, I did some stop motion in that episode. And then we had the creature that we had rod puppets, and we were erasing the rods and, you know, and I actually wanted to do a sequel. We had a sequel that we might do if we ever do another season. We had a sequel to The Finger that's like E.T., where there's like two kids and their parents are getting divorced and the kids are in the backseat of the car and they hear a thump and the car pulls into the garage and the kids get out and Bob has been hit by the car and they take him into the garage and they nurse him back to health. So it's like E.T., but the parents are getting divorced and they're really nasty. And so, you know, crazy stuff. I love the idea of us too. You know, who knows? That was my E.T. meets Bob version. But he did have that little bit of that vibe. It's interesting. I found an artist online who had a design of a creature that was very similar to that. So I reached out to him and said, look, I love this design. I want to license it from you. And we gave him a credit on the show. And we paid him some money. And we sort of took some liberties in regards to what we ultimately wanted it to be. But, you know, it could have been easy. I could have just said, there it is. Let's just do it. But I being very respectful of other artists, I wanted to give him credit where credit was due for that. And it was fun. We had a great time. And DJ was so game for anything and everything. And we really had a good time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He sells it. I've actually for a while thought he was a very underrated actor. I was in college kind of when his like sex comedies were kind of coming out. And then, you know, I've watched a lot of his other roles going forward. And he was in the Cabinet of Curiosities in the role. So I think I'd love to see him.
I don't really remember any instances where, you know, I think because we had to provide linear output for AMC as well, that there were instances where we did have to trim some stuff that was going to air on the network. But I don't really believe that there were any instances that I objected to, like, oh, this is bullshit. You know, what do you guys? Mm-hmm. They were pretty, you know, Shudder. I think Shudder wants to push the envelope.
Right.
So they don't really mind. It's just a matter of the stuff that's trimmed when it airs on the AMC.
Yeah, the only thing that I've noticed, Greg, about the AMC thing, which
is unavoidable is that they've got to make room for the commercials. And so sometimes the stories have, and I've always objected to this, there's nothing you can do about it, but when you take something that was not conceived for television with the natural breaks written in, the people that make those decisions, and I've had Clive Barker's Book of Blood is a film that I did a few years ago, and it was sold to Sci-Fi, and the television version is denuded, you know, it's neutralized somehow.
But, you know, it's tricky because sometimes even if there is a natural break, then you have an act that's only 3 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's like, you have to, you're sort of, your hand is kind of forced a little bit as to where you actually need to put.
Hey, AMC is running Creature.
To put your brakes. But look, I prefer watching things without commercials anyway, because it's you know, that's the benefit of streaming, is because you're not interrupted with Ozempic or Skyrizi commercials every five frickin' seconds.
Right.
A little bit. I mean, look, the nice thing about season four was is that they paired it with Daryl Dixon. But still, people don't know, they don't really know much about the show. The show is still kind of a hidden gem. Well, we really, you know, the first season really did help put Shudder on the map.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, their marching orders for us was, you know, well, we need to get more subscribers. And I said, well, look, everybody that watched Creepshow that signed up, they're going to come back. And, you know, it's always about, like, how do we get more subscribers? How do we, you know, but asking that and then cutting our budget. So it's like you have less money. So we can't bring in the talent that people would want to see. So.
All right, I've got a couple quick questions. Seen that?
No, I don't even know.
How did you feel about the parody that South Park did? I wasn't familiar with this, but they said in 2019, South Park did a parody of Creepshow. Did you have? Okay, well,
yeah.
Is there any truth to that?
There is truth to that. We shot an episode. It was one that John directed. The episode was in post-production. I was actually working on John's cut. And then there was some untrue allegations about Manson that have since been that the rights are so convoluted. The rights are really convoluted because the original movie was produced by Saleh Hassanein and, you know, or financed by Saleh, Richard Rubenstein produced, and then Warner Brothers bought it. And so we actually, during season two, Matt Vane and I actually developed and wrote a sequel to The Crate. And it was Hal Holbrook was still alive, and he lived in a nursing home outside of Atlanta. So we were going to actually shoot with Hal Holbrook. He was down for it. And we had the script written, and it was a really great story about the fact that he's in this assisted living facility, and there's this one character that's bullying him. And at one point he says, "You better be careful what you do, because I'm not going to let you get away with it." And he's like, "Oh, really? What are you going to do about it?" And he tells him how he got rid of his wife because he found this creature, and that the creature was thrown into this quarry. So the guy goes to the quarry and lo and behold, finds that the crate had been dragged out of the quarry by the creature into a cave. So anyway, we had it all written and it was done. I still have the script. And Stan Spry came back and said, "We can't find a clean chain of title to the story." So, and we had already spent the money to write the script. And Matt and I were really, really excited about it. And I thought it was, we'll try to get elements in there. You know, I did the one episode with all the giant bugs, and, you know, like the one with Josh, with Josh in it, but, and Keith David, I can't remember the name of it right now, and Ashley Lawrence. But you know, we try to find elements to sort of pay tribute to the original Creepshow. Yeah. I have the little ashtray right here. Yeah, hold on, I have it right here, and the little crate that we put in the attic.
Oh, there we go.
So this is the one that was in the attic, and then look, there's the ashtray right on top.
Yeah. That's amazing.
That was Lucas Gottfried, who was, who back then was our prop master, and he, you know, he's been with me on Walking Dead for years. You know, we talk about Jordy Verrill a lot because the Jordy Verrill episode is so sort of out of character for what you expect from Stephen King George Romero collaboration. Yeah. John, were you the first AD on that movie?
I was, which was kind of an amazing story in itself, because I'm sitting at home. We knew George. My partners and I had a small film production company in the Berg. And, of course, once you started down that path, you were inevitably going to encounter George. And we called him up. This is a great story about George Romero. I'm sitting in my office, and my partner, Dusty Nelsinger, then had gotten a deal to do all these sports documentaries. And I called him to just offer our services in case he needed anything. I figured a secretary would answer. I'd get on the call sheet, and Pat Buba, my other partner, becoming his editor. And one day I'm sitting at home, and I get a call from Richard Rubenstein, who says, look, George really doesn't like the sheet. Was just tell everybody to show up at 7 o'clock in the morning, and we'll figure out what we're going to shoot. Well, of course, when you're dealing with stars like Hal Holbrook and Fritz Weaver and stuff like that, and the union, SAG and DGA and everything, then you have to be a little bit more formal.
All right. Well, we're almost out of time. So, Greg, John's got to answer this question many times, so I'll put you on the spot for this one. You know, we're dads from the crypt. We give dad advice and mentor advice all the time. So our formal end of interview episode, what mentor fatherly advice would you like to give our audience? It could be about filmmaking, about being a good person.
Well, if you want it to be about filmmaking, I would say really embrace the classics. You got to be real careful. A lot of the stuff that's being made today, and I'm not saying it's bad because there's great stuff. You know, Talk to Me was great. When Evil Lurks was great. But a lot of stuff that's being done today just feels like it's a carbon copy or a clone of something else that's been done. You know, I am a huge fan of the classics, and I think that that's where everything started from. And I would just say it will make you a better filmmaker to pay respect to the classics and really understand that if you're going to make a movie, you have to have a great script, and your actors, you have to believe your actors, because you can have the greatest monster in the world, but it's the shot of the actor's face reacting to the monster that is what's terrifying. You know, if you imagine the, you know, shot from Psycho of her seeing Norman Bates coming at her and putting her hand up over her mouth, or Dee Wallace watching the werewolf transformation in The Howling. That's where the terror really starts. It's from watching how somebody else reacts, because as a viewer, we put ourselves into that person's perspective. So really understand that when you're crafting the scare in your movie, that it's all about the person in the room and how you identify with them.
Yeah, I know I think it's the 45th anniversary of Alien is coming up. And yeah, the reactions to the alien in that movie are so spectacular, especially the chestburster scene.
Yeah.
That they hadn't seen it before they shot it, and they got their genuine reactions.
I'm glad you brought that up. One of the most interesting things, I had a party here once years ago, and you know, it was Walking Dead. I think it was a Walking Dead creep show party. Like, I invited both crews, and it was during COVID, so everybody was really keen to like get out and be human beings. So I had a full house, and we're upstairs in the movie room, and the dailies, like the outtakes from the chestburster scene, were playing in my movie room, and people were sitting there watching it. And I walked up and I said, when you watch these dailies, you would never imagine for a million years that that's the scene that they would have cut together. Cause you see the dailies and you see the tube of blood hitting Veronica Cartwright, and how phony it looks. Cause it looks like somebody's literally aiming a hose at her. But when you cut that scene together and you put the sound effects and you use just the right snippets here and there, that to me, if you watch the outtakes of the chestburster scene, that is a masterclass in storytelling and filmmaking.
Right. Because, yeah, if you look at every element, at least from the alien part, it doesn't look great. Like, it looks, if you just look at the little thing just like kind of going through the table, it's obviously on the little track. It's all the simplest tricks in the world.
Yeah.
But cut together and the reactions is what sells it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, hopefully you got many, many more in you because I want to see it. Greg, what have you got coming up that you want to talk about?
Well, you know, we're currently working on season two of Dead City in Boston, which is the Negan and Maggie Walking Dead spinoff. I'm due to head off to Europe in August to shoot season three with Daryl Dixon. And, you know, we did Fallout, the effects for Fallout, mm-hmm. which you can see. There's a lot of K&B, cool K&B stuff in there. And, I got a lot of stuff brewing. You know, we have a writer and, we're developing Swan Song, the Robert McCammon novel mm-hmm. as a series. And, I'm producing two other movies that we're about to go out with, and, setting up my first feature directing gig.
So that's awesome.
Lots and lots of fun stuff. And then John and I are going to do something together at some point soon. That's the one we're not allowed to talk about.
All right. Well, hopefully more to be revealed. And, you know, we're always hungry for more. So keep us fed.
Yeah, sure.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. Do you have any socials you want to reference for people to find you?
I mean, I'm on Instagram once a year, so I don't know how exciting that is. But it's at Gina Cotero on Instagram. But I haven't posted much. It's too challenging for me.
All right. John?
Yeah, I'm sort of the same way, although I've got an Instagram and a Facebook account. And Official John Harrison is what it is. You can find it on Instagram and stuff like that. But... anyway, it's really great to be on the show. It's really great that you have this audience and keep feeding it, Jason. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. All right. Well, that wraps up another episode of Dads from the Crypt.
Follow Dads from the Crypt on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or I will follow you to the grave. No, seriously, you really should watch, but be careful what you axe for. You may get it. Ha 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 ha.